Welcome to the Development Download with Leaps and Bounds.
Welcome back to Development Download. I'm Lisa Koosman, occupational therapist and owner of Leaps and Bounds.
And I'm Erin, occupational therapist here at Leaps and Bounds. Today, we're doing something a little different. We're talking with an adult who has autism about their personal experiences.
As therapists, we often talk about sensory processing from a clinical perspective. Today, we get to hear about what it feels like from the inside, the daily experiences, challenges, and strengths that come with a unique sensory profile.
Our guest today, Max, has graciously agreed to share their story and help us all understand a bit more about what sensory processing can look like in real life.
Max, thanks so much for joining us today. We're super excited to hear about your perspective. And we know you lecture all over the place, so we're so excited that we are blessed to have you here. Can you start by telling our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Hi, I'm Max. I am an autistic adult. I go to Leaps and Bounds. I went here as a kid and now as an adult. I am training to be a mental health counselor, working exclusively with autistic people. I do that sometimes in my business, Max Talks About Autism, where I give lectures, offer peer groups, loan tools out and equipment for local folks, and provide one-on-one services as well. And I'm also excited to be here.
Yeah. And you even go into classrooms too, don't you?
I do,
and
yeah.
And teach little kids. What grades did you do recently?
Kindergartners and fourth graders for our most recent.
Yeah. And you have a funny story about those kindergartners, don't you?
So it was my first time lecturing to a kindergarten classroom, and it was for a disability day the school had put on, and apparently the teacher had explained to kindergartners what disabilities were, and the kids were never latched on to being blind. And so I went in with my, I have a Julia doll, the autistic Muppet from Sesame Street, and I brought in a bunch of interactive stuff, and I fielded questions for 20 minutes about being blind. I'm not blind. I tried to redirect.
Like kindergartners, right?
Like kindergartners are like, how can you see if you're blind? I'm like, well, I'm not blind, but how can you read if you're blind? Like, do you know Braille? And I said, no, I'm not blind.
That was just the example the teacher used.
Yeah. And so the next year I came back and the teacher had rephrased it a little differently, and I appreciated that.
Oh, man. Well, everyone experiences the world through their senses, but for people with autism, those sensations can sometimes feel a little different. Can you describe your sensory experiences just from a day-to-day kind of?
I don't know any different because I've always been this way. But it's like, I mean, it's basically things are too loud, too bright, too much generally. And then also I'm a bit hyperactive. And that's also been throughout my life. So I think the clinical language is I under-respond to like different sensory stuff like vestibular or whatever, and then I over-respond to like light touch and just, oh.
I get that.
Or light bulbs, and I know that's common in autistic people because the autistic brains don't filter out things that non-autistic brains do, like the sound of lights or the sound of fans or whatever minor sound, it becomes amplified in my brain.
Yeah, well, and you even have talked about just walking into schnooks, right?
Like, yeah.
What are some things that you came out of just walking through?
The schnooks is not my usual grocery store. I'm Aldi for life. The grocery stores that are not Aldi, like schnooks, typically they play really loud music all over. And it's like different music in different parts of the store. Sometimes they have live performers, which is weird to me. Like, I don't need a concert when I'm shopping for groceries. The lights are always on, and they have like the brightest, loudest lights imaginable. Smells, especially because Schnucks has like those like warm food areas where you like make your own salad or like pick up lunch or whatever, and it's just so much.
I didn't even think about that, like how all these, they don't have that.
They don't
just all have the packaged food, so yeah. I didn't think about that.
I didn't either.
They don't play music, and there's the aisle of shame, the middle aisle.
I do love the...
Where I've gotten quite a few cool things.
Thinking about other ways to think about sensory, what are some things that you find really calming or really like that you gravitate toward in terms of sensory?
Moving in general. I was talking to my mom earlier today about the questions, and she said that even as a baby, I love to swing and climb things in ways that my brother and sister, who are not autistic, didn't, or to an over relation of that, so I've all or over per, in an excess to, it was completely not matched what neurotypical or non-autistic siblings did. I have always liked swinging, climbing things, jumping, falling, being squished. When my brother and I were kids, I would have him lift up his mattress in his room, and I would get under the mattress, and then he would lay on top of the mattress, and it was just like this feeling of like, okay, things are all right. Mm-hmm. And as I've gotten older and things like awareness has spread, there's like things like weighted blankets, which like when I first got my weighted blanket in, I was a sophomore in high school, and it was back when like you had to special order it from this specialty website. It was like way too expensive, and it took like 3 weeks to make. And I still have that blanket because it is really well made. but now you can get them at Target or
the Isle of Shame at Aldi.
You
too.
Can get it there.
Or Amazon.
Amazon, yeah. Whatever store you frequent. Walgreens maybe, I don't know.
Max, I'm thinking about that picture you recently posted on your social media where you are swinging and look so, so happy.
Yeah. Swings have always calmed me down, and obviously I can't swing everywhere.
Yeah.
I personally have been lucky to have my dad help me hang up swings in my house so I can, just the carabiner, so I can swap out different swings. I've been very creative about how to get that input. My favorite swing I have at my house is actually a hammock that I folded up like a long ways. Mm. And then I have like typical swing. My front yard has two big trees, and luckily my nieces and nephews live close by, so I always have an excuse to hang up new swings.
When all the neighborhood kids tend to like find your swings as well.
Yes, I'll come home and they'll be like on them. And I'm like, oh, great. Like, I'm glad you enjoy them. Yeah. I do too. So they're all school age. So during the day is, during school day is my time for them swinging. So when I was really little, I was diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder and OCD and depression. And I've gotten, I think the generalized anxiety disorder was a misdiagnosis. Again, it was 2006, so like not a lot of people knew about sensory stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was anxious all of the time. And then coming as an adult, I realized over the past couple of years that like, oh, wow, I don't have generalized anxiety disorder. I just am anxious when my needs are not being met, sensory needs.
I love that you said that, because I think that we talk to families about that a lot, that if you are experiencing the world in, you know, just walking through the grocery store is so stressful with all the sounds, I mean, that would be anxiety producing for anyone.
It would be a lot. And that's all day, every day. Obviously not in grocery stores, but at home.
Absolutely.
At school, driving in the car, work. It's all there.
Yeah. And I know we've kind of talked about swings and things like that, but is there any other ways that you tend to manage sensory overload? Is there any specific other tools or routines or strategies that make a difference?
I buy a lot of fidgets. They're really cheap on Amazon if you buy them in bulk, and that is important because I'm a college student. So not necessarily doing
cheap
great
things training. Are good. Yeah.
I'm pretty rough on my fidgets, so I do have to replace them quite a bit. But that helps. I get really anxious in car rides and then I'm sitting for a long period of time. So I have this wobble cushion again on Amazon. It's like not expensive. I think the last one I got was like $10. There's a lot of tutorials online about how to make your own sensory stuff if you're crafty, which I'm not. But a lot of it is just experimentation. I also really like the idea of noise canceling headphones. Real ones are, again, very expensive. And also, if like you're shopping for sensory stuff and you type in the search bar like sensory stuff or whatever you're searching, but it has the word sensory in it or autism or special needs, it's going to be way jacked up in price. So I searched for shooting earmuffs. I don't go hunting, but these little earmuffs, I'll attach a picture. They're pretty good. They're heavy, which helps with my head being compressed. And they block out sound pretty well to what point where I can still hear people talking next to me, but I don't hear all of the background noise. And these were, I think, $9.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, but if you search sensory earmuffs, it's going to be like a lot more than
this. No, I think that's important too, because financially, sometimes I think some of the tools can feel overwhelming, especially to parents. So to have other options, I think, is great.
And to find the right tools that make sense for you. So maybe, like, because this one compresses your head enough. And so sometimes it's a little bit of detective work, right? To find what's the right fit for each person.
My best friend is also autistic, and he also experiences overstimulation from noises. And he is very big into earmuffs. The like construction workers wear.
Yeah.
I know they make loop earplugs, which a lot of my friends rave about, but I don't like things in my ears. So I'm like, no.
Right.
That's perfect.
Do you remember the first time you realized that these sensory experiences affected you differently than they might other people?
I know my mom told me that when I was going into kindergarten, I had parents as teachers come over, and the evaluator said that I had fine motor issues because I couldn't button a coat or do zippers. And there was one other thing. Oh, I couldn't cut like using scissors at all. I still can't, but that's fine.
You're managing.
There's not that many things in my adult life I have to cut out. I think it must have been around early school age when I started noticing, like, just offhand, like, oh wow, other kids can do this. And then as I got older, it was like I knew, like, in high school and early community college, I was like, okay, well, I know I'm autistic and it causes sensory stuff to be amplified. But it was still very much a struggle to, like, sit through classes. And this was, like, I graduated high school in 2016, so it's been almost a decade. And, like, this wasn't at a time when, like, it was acceptable to bring, like, fidgets into class. And really, you couldn't really move in the way I needed to. I think if I went back and, was able to move around now, I think I would have done a lot better academically. But then just also, my mom is from Oklahoma, and so we went to Oklahoma to visit my family there 5 or 6 times a year for the first 15, 16 years of my life. So I spent a lot of time there. And my cousins had a trampoline in their backyard and also a zip line and, like, this really cool swing. And it was then that I was like, hey, no one else was enjoying this as much as I am. Like, everyone else is having a good time, but, like, I don't want to stop. Like,
Maybe, could I ask a question about, you were talking about school and that fidgets weren't as acceptable. You're such a great advocate for yourself now. Like, how have you, what are some ways that you've been able to advocate for yourself and your being in the community and in your learning experience?
Well, I chose an online school because it was the fastest option to earn my degree, because it's 7-week courses instead of the 16-week standard course. But also because it's online, and a lot of my accommodations that I received through school up into college, in-person college, were not needed anymore because everyone submitted their work through a computer No one could see me fidgeting either. I took a literature course a couple of years ago. It was a really fun class. It didn't count for credit because I've taken too many English classes to count for credit anymore. But I think I read the readings for that week out in one chunk in one of my swings. Out in the community, I don't like to go out much. When I am out, I'm pretty good at packing fidgets in my pockets, and I can, you know, tolerate things, and then I'm going to pay for it later, metaphorically. But I can still tolerate things. I think a lot of that is just practice and also just not having a choice. I say often when I'm leading my skill groups that it's from an autistic affirming approach. And what I mean by that is I always make a point of saying, you know, autistic social skills or autistic needs is not bad or less than. That's what I was taught when I was in social skills groups as a kid and teenager. And just the world isn't made for autistic people. And so to succeed in this world or to do what you want to do, you unfortunately, you as an autistic people, unfortunately have to learn the ways of the non-autistic people. And part of that is tolerating unpleasant sensory stuff. I think everyone has a different threshold for that. I know on certain days going to like Costco is like, oh my God, I think I would rather do anything else than this.
I don't think you're alone in that.
Yeah.
Costco is over.
Especially
on a weekend.
everybody's there. I think I've had to work through a lot of shame because I can, to people who don't know a lot about autism, I'm flagged as weird, but not autistic. And then people who know about autism are like, oh, you're autistic. I'm like, yep. So I definitely think broader awareness of what autism can look like. And non-toddler boys from middle-class backgrounds who the diagnostic criteria was created for that population. So it's like no wonder I didn't show up on screenings then because it wasn't made for the majority of the population.
Yeah. Well, and many of our listeners are parents of kids with sensory processing differences. What would you want them to know about how their child might be feeling? But to also too, like, you are a voice. And so, like, I know you go in and really help to increase that understanding. And so could you tell us a little bit about, like, what would you want them to know? Because some of these kids might not have a voice or have an understanding yet.
So one of the services I provide is I will talk to parents of newly diagnosed children or families of newly diagnosed adults. Especially with kids, oftentimes they either cannot communicate in a way that is acceptable for them yet, because they're really young children. Maybe they can communicate verbally, but what they're saying verbally is not representative of what they can actually understand, which is why I love a lot of the people I work with have started been on, especially the younger population, have been training on AAC devices since preschool. And I'm like, that is so cool because you really get that. I hate the term autism red flags and early intervention because it makes it sound like you're trying just a red flag. It's like, well, it's not measles, right?
It's not
cancer. It just is. And I'm not saying that autism can't be disabling and be really overwhelming. And I know lots of families and individuals need way more support than what they're currently getting. But just the idea of red flags rubbed through the wrong way. But I do think a lot of the early intervention stuff, really speech language pathologists have been leading the charge for the neurodiversity movement among like professionals who work a lot with autistic people. So if the kid is not able to, or individual is not able to express things, because I know for a long time I wasn't able to express things that I was feeling. Like when I first started working with Erin a couple of years ago, she'd be like, are you feeling overwhelmed? And I'm like, I don't know. Like, what does overwhelmed feel like? I would work with the person, you know, understand that they enjoy, say that this is not a death sentence. I know a certain advocacy group that shall not be named, which I'm not a fan of, put a thing out when they partnered with Sesame Street a few years ago about how the first 100 days book about how you should mourn the child after you get an orphan diagnosis in the same way you would mourn a child who's gotten like a cancer diagnosis. And like, okay, you know, autism is, you know, can be deeply disabling and there are more supports needed and people, some people need supports their whole life. I'm not discounting any of that. However, you're not going to die from it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like you don't have to watch your kid go through chemotherapy and radiation and surgery then still maybe die or have late effects throughout their entire life.
Well, I love that you are going into a career so that way you can continue that understanding. And I think I'm super excited as you're entering into this like ability to really start making change. So I'm impressed and in awe, and I don't know. I don't really have the words to really tell you, but I am super impressed. And I love that you're here even sharing with us today. So
thanks again. To going back to the other question, I would let parents know it isn't a death sentence that, you know, when I was diagnosed in middle school as autistic, teachers didn't think I would graduate high school. And like the way I was at 11, I also thought I would not graduate high school. So like when you look at like your 5-year-old kid or however many years old your kid is, no one can accurately say, oh, this kid is going to be need this intensive support all their life. Some people do. And then I also emphasize to parents that it's currently classified as a developmental disorder. I know certain people like delay disorder. I prefer the term delay personally, but development happens out of order. Like I have always been very good at English and reading and writing and political science and things like that. And I do present all over the country every year, but I also cannot tie my shoes. And I can't read a traditional clock face. Obviously now there are tools to do that, but I think a lot of, especially in my experience, ABA providers are like, oh, a child has to be like table ready first. Like, no, like if I had been denied actual education until I could sit still at the table, I would have never advanced to that.
Right. Yeah. And shoe tying, as an example, if we get stuck on some of those, you know, what people consider developmental patterns, we miss the whole myriad of things that they could be doing.
And I would say that like high support identified need autistics are denied the chance to show what they learn mm-hmm. and show what they know and what they can do. And low support need identified autistics are denied the support they need to do things.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And yeah, the shoe tying example, I mean, if we stuck on shoe tying, you would miss, I mean, all of the amazing things that you're doing. And how important is shoe tying in any of that?
Really
not important. I think you were touching on this, but so we work with so many parents that maybe as they're trying to figure out their child might be doing some things that might look like might be hard for that parent to understand. So maybe a child scratches themselves and has a really big reaction, and the parent's gut reaction is to say, you're fine, you're okay. But if that child has sensory processing difficulties, then they're experiencing that in a different way. And so what do you want parents to know about those kids that have sensory processing difficulties?
That you may not know what they're experiencing. It may look like they're experiencing just a scratch on the arm, but for them that can be the worst for a variety of reasons. The way wind feels on it, the way water feels on it, the way their shirt rubs against it. If they run their fingers along their skin, having that interruption of like normal skin, the color, it can be a lot of things. And I think asking, one of the questions I ask a lot when I'm working with parents before I start working with their kid is obviously for adults and adolescents, I like to talk to the person first, but it's useful when I'm working with children to ask the parents what they think and to really understand the function behind the behavior. I like the phrase, all behavior is communication.
Yeah.
So like someone, every behavior is telling you something. Just to not take it at face value. And obviously that can be hard to tell because maybe your kid just really cries a lot and has a really low pain threshold. Or maybe your kid just has a very low frustration tolerance and that's why they cry so much. And it's not that they aren't trying, it's that they are not able at that moment to have the skills. I always hear children do well if they can.
Mm-hmm.
And so if the kid has, I know personally in my own life, having like different sensory supports I use, whether it's a resistance band or weighted blankets or wiggle seats in the car or whatever, having that ability to sort of piece together my needs so that they're met,
mm-hmm.
I do a lot better, whether it's academically, at work, socially, etc. And that, I think a lot of people don't understand that like pain is like a sensory thing too.
Right.
I personally have like a very extremely high pain tolerance,
mm-hmm.
to the point where I've like, the example I always give is I've broken my left ankle, I think 5 or 6 times.
Oh gosh.
And I didn't know it until I broke it so badly a piece of bone chipped off. And I had to get the surgery to get it removed, but I would just walk around on a broken ankle until it healed, and then I'd fracture it again and then walk around until it healed.
Mm-hmm.
And so to the point where I went to urgent care for the time the bone piece fell off, they were like, how many broken ankles have you had? And I'm like, oh, 0. And they're like, well.
Not true.
That's what the x-ray didn't show. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of that. And I know some people have very low pain thresholds.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where like ordinary activities can be painful. I know there's a lot of talk about like desensitizing therapy or like exposure therapy, and I think like all therapies, it should be you should have an understanding that it's going to be conducted in an ethical way that's backed by science, while also like keeping in mind that like I really think the child, or at least the parents, should have like a really good understanding of like, hey, because like some people do need to, we all need to learn to cope with things. And so if something is like really bothering that kid, it's like, it's going to suck. And also weighing like, is this kid really actually distressed? Like if the kid is really distressed, like you're not going to get any therapeutic work done.
Right.
Well,
and what you're describing is it's, all of it is what makes the sensory system so complex, yeah. Right? You might have a situation where your brain is not registering pain from a broken ankle, but then your brain is really registering the sounds or smells in the environment. And
exactly.
And that can look so different for people and different on different days at times too, right?
Different days, yeah. I noticed I always start out with swimming. When I come in, I know that after I've been swinging, I'm much calmer. I can do harder thing activities,
mm-hmm.
like visual motor, fine motor, or reflex integration stuff.
Yeah.
Which is really hard, and I might not be able to do it on the average day, but when I take time to stabilize my sensory system sort of before and after,
mm-hmm.
the hard activity, I'm more able to do it. At the same point, if your kid is stressed out all day long, I know a lot of kids can hold it together while they're at school and then come home and fall apart. I'm like, that
right.
used to be me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think scheduling decompression time, and also maybe to the extent you can. And I know with the special ed federal cuts, it's going to be harder and harder to access accommodations that your kid is legally, for now, legally entitled to under the Americans with Disabilities Act in Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act of 1974 and IDEA. I recommend all parents who have a kid with a disability or health condition learn all they can about special education.
It's a challenge, but it's also a responsibility of the parent to continue advocating for those. That parent's going to know their child the best. So
yeah.
Advocating for their needs as
and
well.
And it will be hard. And you're going to have to learn a lot of legal terms you never thought you'd have to know.
Right.
and, you know, schools are already underfunded, and wanting to accommodate a child versus having the resources versus having a parent who knows exactly what their kid is deserved is all taken into effect.
Yeah. Well, Max, you have shared so much great information. We are so thankful that you have given us your firsthand experience. And I think you've helped paint a picture of what sensory processing might look like for an individual that is struggling with that.
Yeah.
And so that was our goal, is to really help parents, give parents a firsthand experience of that. So thank you so much for doing that. If this conversation sparks some questions, or you are thinking of your own child's sensory profile, we encourage you to reach out to an occupational therapist or continue to look at resources on sensory processing and self-regulation. Thanks so much, Max. And thank you guys. You bet. Thank you guys for tuning in to the Development Download. We'll be back soon with more insights to help kids and families thrive at every stage of development. See you guys next time.
You've been listening to The Development Download with Leaps and Bounds.